whether that's on an electronic device or one of the chair Bibles in the chair racks. But we're looking at Hebrews chapter 12 as we continue a series through the book of Hebrews. Today, looking at Hebrews chapter 12, the second half, verses 14 to 29. In those chair Bibles, it's found on page 845. Page 845. It'll also be up on the screen, but we're looking at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 14 to 29. I'd like you to follow along as I read it. Make every effort to live in peace with everyone and to be holy. Without holiness, no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one falls short of the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son. Afterward, as you know, when he wanted to inherit his blessing, he was rejected, even though he sought the blessing with tears. He could not change what he had done. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned to death. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised once more, I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. The words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. The word of the Lord. Two mountains are here, and you know that I love mountains. So whether it is in lots of different places that I've got to see them, I have been blessed to get to be not only climbing many mountains, but seeing many mountains, and whether it has been mountains in Montana or Austria, Wyoming or Scotland, California or Bavaria, Idaho or Iceland, I have gotten to see and be on some beautiful, beautiful mountains. Now, it's interesting that we would say many times when we face those things, how awesome. But yet we use that word so much, you wonder if we're going to, if you will, make it common and therefore wear it out. And that's the task that is what we must face this day. Words that we will use to describe incredible magnitude, and then we try to use them to describe the creator of that magnitude, and so the word becomes, if you will, inadequate, overused, incapable of describing it. Now, you may not be into mountains, and that's fine. But the idea is, I want you to make sure you understand that the mountains that are contrasted here today are used as an illustration, and they're very physical as well. They really are two mountains in history, and the idea is those two mountains are giving a contrast to help us understand you are climbing a mountain. It's called life. It's your approach to life, and everyone has something that they're worshiping, something that they're focused on, some summit that their life is pressing toward. Everyone does. Something is ultimate in your life. What we hold as ultimate is what we worship. It's what has our hearts. It's what has grabbed and captivated us. Whatever that is, and there are many choices out there in the world. For instance, many people in our culture choose accomplishment. They will sacrifice their family for accomplishment. They will sacrifice any other involvement for accomplishment. They will sacrifice relationships of any kind for accomplishment. Accomplishment is the focus. It's the summit. It's the mountain that they are pursuing, and everything else is secondary to that. Some people worship money. That's what they're going. If you mess with their money, you're going to find out where their heart really is at. Some people worship sex or their sexual identity. Some people worship control. Just mess with their order and the way they do things. And, you know, that's what's going to tear and help them to find out what's that really important in their life. Some people, it's drugs or alcohol. It's substance that they're addicted to. Just try and take it away and see what happens, and you'll find that it was an item of worship. You see, in a sense, every one of us, we're climbing some mountain. There is something that is the ultimate endeavor and ultimate focus of our life. And the question is, which mountain are you climbing? These two mountains, the mountain of fear that's represented by Mount Sinai, or the mountain of joy, represented by Mount Zion. Which mountain are you climbing? Now you understand that these two mountains are often appearing in illustrations and little snippets and oftentimes, and in this text, pretty intensely focused here. But the idea is we look at these two mountains and they represent the contrast of life that's common. So climbing the mountain of fear is what many, many people do. And you might say, well, you know, I'm not really walking in fear. Oh, see, it isn't just a fear of this abject fear that cowers in the corner, though it also included that in the description, and we'll see that in a minute. But it is also that idea of, if this thing were taken away, does your life fall apart? If it's your kids and they're taken away, will your life absolutely crumble? If your occupation, if your spouse, what is the thing that would be taken away, would crush you? And we find that in many people, that is what they worship. Note that in both verse 18 and verse 22, in these contrasts, it says that you have come. That phrase, that you have come, that phrase is a phrase of religious approach. In other words, it isn't just saying that you've sort of haphazardly wandered into something. No, it is a sense of bowing down, of abeyance, of saying, I'm choosing. I have come with a religious devotion. I have chosen by the endeavor of my very soul to approach and to press into this thing. And it gives us these two contrasts of those who have come to the first mountain and those who have come with this religious sense of devotion to the second mountain. So they're in contrast. Many people approach God with accomplishment, not just of their occupation, those kind of things, but with their religious devotion. I chat with people and I find and I ask them and I try and help to understand if they're a believer in Jesus Christ, if they really do understand the gospel or if they're just attending church. And I'll ask them things like, are you a Christian? And they'll give answers something like, you know, well, I'm pretty good. Or I'm trying really hard. Or I'm doing my best. But you see, I want you to make sure you understand and look at what the standard that God gives us is. Notice the standard, verse 14. We can stop at just the first one. Make every effort to live in peace. Now, we're going to go on from there, but let's just pause with that one. Think about the last conflict that you were in, whether with your spouse, your child, your parent, with a coworker. Ask yourself honestly, did you make every effort to live in peace? Every effort? I think when we're stepping back and looking at a given requirement, we find ourselves saying, no. No, as a matter of fact, I don't know if I've ever done my very best at anything. I've never left it absolutely all there. But it doesn't just do that. It asks then also, be holy. Okay, well, we could really take some time with that. Do not let a bitter root, verse 15. Verse 16, no sexual immorality, no attraction outside of the bonds of marriage within a husband and wife. None. And then also it says, don't be short-sighted, going for this world's only rewards like Esau did, as verse 16 goes on. Verse 15, it says, now go back again. So that was the list. How are we doing? At the first one, I think we could show that we're all not making the standard. Good enough, I'm trying hard, won't ever make it. But then think about the idea, even if you could take that whole list that just we were just given in those few verses, even if you could take that list and you could say, honestly, I really have done all of that thing. Then notice what it also says in this important phrase, that you, it says here, see to it that everybody else is doing that as well. Wait, what a minute? That person that's sitting over here across the aisle from you? That person sitting down the row? The guy in front of you, the gal behind you, see to it that they do all these things too. How well have you done at that? See, it's the golden rule, isn't it? Make sure that we're giving more to the other person than to ourselves. How have I done really at putting everybody else first versus myself? And the answer is, honestly, I've done terrible. Awful. I put myself first all the time, and it's a war and a fight to put anybody before me. So we look at that, and we see the mountain of fear, and coming to understand that really is the standard. This is not just some idea or concept. That's the standard. Do you see why it's called the mountain of fear? So the picture of God showing up with the people of Israel at Mount Sinai, and they end up saying, no, turn him away, turn him back. I cannot face it. No more words. Please, God, go away. They cannot stand in the midst of that. It's too awful. Notice verse 18, what the descriptors are. They faced burning fire. They faced darkness. They faced gloom. They faced storm. They faced a trumpet blast. It wasn't a marching band trumpet blast. It was the trumpet of an attacking army bringing absolute crush and doom. That's what we're told in verse 18, that mountain represented. And even then, verse 21 tells us that even Moses, this guy who got to live face to face with God, even Moses said, I am trembling with fear because God showed up. See, God shows up, and our bravado, our excuses for half-hearted efforts, our sense of saying, I've tried my best, it just gets burned away to nothing. It's gone. I listened to a sermon, and my favorite preacher to listen to is Tim Keller. I know I've shared from him many times, and I actually listened to Tim Keller preach a sermon on this text. And when I listened to that, I just honestly said, you know, I should just quit. I shouldn't even try. I don't know why I do this every week. I should just give up. Now, right now, I'm hoping that some of you are sitting here saying, no, Gary, you're pretty good. You should keep doing this. You should keep your job. I'm hoping that some of you, a couple of you at least, are still thinking that. But here's what I want you to realize. Do you realize you just validated my point? You see, when I compare myself, I'm pretty good, to great, I feel so inadequate. When I compare myself just to human greatness, I feel incredibly inadequate. Think if all of a sudden I was face to face with the God who spoke the stars into existence, what I would now feel like. You see, our rationalization won't work in front of anyone except other people. It won't work in front of the living God. The mountain of fear is very much about this blinding reality that God has shown up and I am toast. I cannot be sustained in front of absolute holiness. We don't even live our own standards. We say over and over us, every one of us will say in our conscience, I am never going to do that again. I'm never going to get mad at a computer again. And we do. So what about the absolute standard that God puts forth and we really think that we're accomplishing it? You know, again, in my love of mountains, I don't do it so much anymore, but I do still teach some in terms of mountaineering, but it's more alpine mountaineering. But I used to do a bit of technical climbing, and I know that's just everyone's endeavor to get on a cliff face like this. That's what you're hoping to do. And I used to teach that. And one day, I got to tell you this story about this guy, this young kid, he wanted to learn. And he was an intermediate climber. He had done a little bit, but he was ready to take it to the next level. And so he said, Gary, I want you to challenge me. So I went out. And I led the climb, and I went up. So I'm up the guy up standing on a ledge where I can stop, and the first one is called a pitch. So however far that pitch is, it wasn't particularly tall. It was about, I think, 75, maybe 100 feet. I know that's tall for a lot of people. I'm about 100 feet up this cliff, and now he's following me. So I went up first, and I've got the rope going from my waist where I'm tied into the rock here down to him. And one of the techniques, you have to have very clear, expressive techniques about shouting to each other for commands, one-word commands, because if the wind's blowing and it's howling, it's very important that you understand what the command is when you're on the edge of a cliff. And one of the commands that you can use if you're coming up and you're the second or you're the first and you've put in a runner above you is you can call out for tension. Tension means, I'm scared. And I want this rope to be really tight going up above me. So load that baby up and pull on that rope and kind of help hold me up because right now I'm afraid I'm going to fall and I don't want any slack in this rope. So this kid started up this route and he was going up and pretty soon I hear him call from down there, tension! And so I'm, you know, going like this and pulling with my weight to try and give him a little bit of load. And a couple minutes later, he says, tension! His voice has gone up about an octave. And a few minutes later, I hear him go, tension! You know, it is another octave. And pretty soon he's, oh, this is awful! Tension! You know, and he's saying stuff like, I don't know, what am I doing here? Why am I doing this? He's saying all this kind of stuff. And he finally gets up on the cliff. I kid you not. He comes up, he no more and gets up on the ledge that we're standing on. He goes, oh, I thought I was going to die. How did you do that? That was the most awful thing. Can we do it again? Unless we have an abject sense of fear of who God really is, we will never, ever really capture the awe and the wonder that is before us. And the very thing that should scare us to absolute near death is the very thing that we then come to understand. I can't live without that. That's the most amazing, the most incredible, the most astounding. There just aren't words enough to be able to describe it. That's who God is. You see, we are shown an awesome, fearsome, fiery God to say that the true wonder of what this whole life is all about is not anywhere near as wonderful as who He is. But it causes us both to shy away and at the same time have this incredible attraction to who He is. We pursue something awesome because we are created for worship. That's why everyone worships. Everyone worships something. Everyone is a worshiper. It's what we worship, which mountain we're climbing. And you will never find fulfillment pursuing non-lofty, awesome things. If you're pursuing unawesome things that cannot shine in the light of that awesomeness, then what you are worshiping is going to burn. It will be shaken. It will be torn down. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I am justly condemned in my worship of the little things that I put in place in my life. So what is worthy of awe and wonder, you're asking? What is worthy of wonder and awe? What is worthy of doing that? As always, I'm so glad you asked. Let's move on to point two, climbing the mountain of joy. Notice in verse 22, there's a tremendous change. I think one of my all-time favorite words in the Bible is that little word, but. But. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God. Notice that there's a mountain and a city. They're used interchangeably. Both of them appear at various times in Scripture. They're used as sometimes the mountain and the mountain, but it's also times the city and the city. And it's the tale of two cities. The whole of the Bible can be put up and summed, in a sense, between these two mountains and between these two cities. The story of the Bible is about man's effort on the one hand to get to God, to climb to Him, to build a city that is worthy of Him, to try and impress Him, to try and help Him to understand how good we are, to weigh out the scales of what we've done. That's the city of man and the endeavor of human effort to reach God. And it's all around us. And frankly, it's in us until it's really worked out by the power of the Spirit of God. And the second one is a mountain where God comes to us. It's a mountain where God comes and descends to us. That's Mount Zion. God comes to us and He brings us what? You notice what He first brings us then when we read the word but? He brings us a party. I know you don't go naturally to think that, but we should. That's what He does. He brings us an incredible, heavenly, unbelievable party. Look at what it says, verse 22. To thousands, this is what He's brought you to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. That word, joyful, or phrase, joyful assembly, is of this festive convocation. It's an incredible celebration, not only of heaven, but of heaven and earth intersecting, whereby there's an incredible display of the glory of God and the incredible ecstasy of the people who get to experience it. He has invited you to that party. But He doesn't just end there, verse 23. He says, you have come now to a mountain whereby you are the church. That is, the gathering, the family, the community. You see, the church is about us being able to show the new city in a little bit, in a little chunk. Just, yes, we'll do it fallibly, but we, the church, have the opportunity of being able to express that there is this city, there is this other mountain that is coming. And so you get to be a part of the gathering. He's called you to it. But then notice, it's not just that you're invited to the party, not just to this church, but to of the firstborn. Which is the church? It's the firstborn. Now, who are the firstborn? In our culture, we don't do this so much, but in many cultures, and in the culture in which this was given, what did it mean to be the firstborn? It meant you got everything. You got the title. You got the land. You got the wealth. You got it all. You didn't do a thing, but you got it all. It was given to you. That's what the church is. It's given to you, all of it. And then notice it says, how do you get this? Well, you were the firstborn. And then it says it again in verse 23, of the names who are written in heaven. Can you write your own name in heaven? Nobody can do that. And so it's people whose names have been, you're passive in that, your names have been written in heaven. You're the spirits of the righteous made perfect. You see, one day Jesus, helping the disciples and you and me to understand that, he sent the 72, not just the 12. In Luke chapter 10, he sent the 72 disciples out. And he said, go from town to town to town to town. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to go out and I want you to heal the sick. And I want you to take those who are demon-possessed and cast the demons out of them. And you know what they did? They went out and they went from town to town and they went around and they healed the sick and they cast out the demons. And they came back, and in Luke 10 it says that they came to him, and the 72 came and said, Lord, even the demons submit to us in your name. And look at what Jesus said. Do not rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Do you see what he's saying? Do not get your identity in anything on this earth, because it will be shaken and it will be burnt and it will be destroyed. Do not get your identity there. Your identity is to be caught up in the fact that your name is written in heaven, that your identity is there. Because all of this here, next time when you go and pray for the demons to be removed, they might not leave. Don't put your identity in spiritual success or in church success or in church growth or in your whatever, all of that list and many, many others that I talked about earlier. You see, life is going to shake you. Only one thing cannot be shaken. Verse 25, God warned them with an earthly shaking. We are warned from heaven. God is shaking. Verse 27, the shaking one day will be done. What are we being told there? That this whole earth, which is shaken, and it is shaken, isn't it? It's shaken in all kinds of ways. Just watch the news, whether by storms or shooting. Look at all the ways. And look in our own heart. It's being shaken. But one day, it won't be shaken anymore. And there will be, verse 28, a kingdom that cannot be shaken. So, let us be thankful. And so, worship God acceptably with reverence and awe. How do we do that? Well, we're going to get to that in a second. Before we do, though, I want you to capture once again why this is so important that our names are written there. I want to use your God-given imagination for a minute. This is going to be a challenge, so sit up straight. Stretch a little bit. Go ahead, come on, deep breath. I want you to use your imagination, all right? Because we're trying to capture something here that is way, way, way beyond us. So work with me. I want you to picture the absolute peak moments of ecstasy in your life. Perhaps, guys, it's when she asked you to marry her. Oh, maybe I did that wrong. Wait. For most of us, those incredible moments include somebody. Picture some of those times when you just found yourself so incredibly over hills in love. You were so amazed at that person. Capture those moments, as many of those as you can. Put them into your memory bank and hang on to them for a second. Then I want you to take the very pinnacle of delight of the things that you have gotten to see. I want you to look and see in your mind's eye again 100 of the top inspiring vistas, sunrises, sunsets, mountain views. Capture them, 100 of them. Grab hold of those, okay? I told you it was going to be tough. And you've got all of those now. And I want you to bring all of those together and put them in one place in your memory. And then here's what I want you to do. I want you to play those in your memory in 3 seconds, just like that. All of that emotion, all of that wonder, all of that awe, all of that sense of incredible. You kidding me? And in that 3 seconds, you just got a little taste of heaven. Just a little. Just a teeny. Little touch on your tongue. That's it. That's all you got. And it goes on for eternity. That's what we're told. This is all going to be shaken. It's nothing compared to what's coming. Why do we put our hope there? C.S. Lewis says, joy is the serious business of heaven. Aim at heaven and you will get earth thrown in. Aim at earth and you will get neither. Your place in heaven will seem to be made for you and you alone, because you were made for it. I have come home at last. This is my real country. I belong here. This is the land I have been looking for all my life, though I never knew it until now. Come further up, come further in. Now you say, Gary, you've captured me. I want heaven. I want that. I want to go there. How can I get there? I want you to notice that we skipped one little phrase that's just inserted peculiarly, really, in the story, but not peculiarly. We skipped one little phrase in verse 23, and I want you to look back at it. All of these incredible descriptions are given us, but right there in the middle of it, you have come to the judge of all. I tell you, you read that passage over and all those great things that we're told there about Mount Zion, and all of a sudden, in the midst of it, there is named in this phrase, the judge of all. What in the world is that about in that context? What have you come to that is the judge of all? I'll show you. Matthew chapter 27, we're shown the picture of the two mountains side by side. And in Matthew 27, we read of the crucifixion of Christ. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook. Do you see Mount Sinai coming pounding in? The earth shook, the rocks split, the tombs broke open. When the centurion who was with him, who were guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified. These are hardened Roman soldiers. These hardened Roman soldiers were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely this was the Son of God." Do you understand what we just read there? You see, Mount Sinai just came pounding down upon Zion, and not specifically upon the mountain, but specifically upon the person of Christ. Mount Sinai just took the whole mountain of fear and all of God's wrath, all of His sense of burning and fire and judgment, and it all had one focal laser point right on the person of Jesus Christ. God's judgment was directed at His Son so we could be brought into the heavenly mountain Zion. He lived the life that I should have lived, and He died the death that I should die. He faced all of that fear so you don't have to face it ever again. He faced all that wrath so you would never have to have it pointed at you. But as long as you keep going at your own endeavor to try and reach the summit of your own mountain, of your own religious activity, and you don't surrender to that sacrifice of Christ, then you still are climbing the mountain of destruction. We can never earn that. It is that this absolute, awful wonder of this God who really does ask for perfection all came focused on one being, the Son of God, in that very moment, and He did it for you. Not so that you'd try and earn it some other way, but that you would finally come to say, "How wicked I am. Who have I been kidding? How awful is my heart? How I've never really tried with my all. I've never even made my own standard, let alone the absolute standard." And that's so today, I say, I give up. I want Christ's record to count for me. I receive it. I stand in awe of it. I trust in it. I continue to express for those of us who have received that gift to say, when did we ever think worship was anything other than the wonder and the awe that it is that He did that for me? All have sinned and fall short, but don't keep pursuing trying to fix it of your own volition and abilities. I give you a quote that I've shared with you and Donna shared with you before. He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot lose. He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. Will you give up your own personal endeavors? Give up thinking that you are not so bad when, in fact, yes, we are. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. The longing The ecstasy, the joy, the hope, the delight that you have longed for all your life is caught up in that very place, in that very idea. It points to a place that holds firmly and will remain and will give you that sense of identity that you have longed for, that sense of meaning, that sense of purpose and hope. But it won't come of your own endeavors. It will come by surrender to Him, whether for the first time this day or again and again and again. This is my hope. Let's pray.